Hello and welcome to our program, Travel, brought to you by OWL Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center. I am Jeff Chandler, and during the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from various travel outlets here on OWL Radio. Let's get started with our first article from the Express News in their social media section, and it's entitled, Influencer Shares Her Love of Fredericksburg. This is by Dennis Rudner, who's a staff writer. Mark Twain famously said, find a job you enjoy doing and you will never have to work a day in your life. That's pretty much sums up Jane Coe's life for the past 10 years. The Port Lavaca native is the one-woman dynamo behind A Taste of Cocoa on Instagram, where she gets to do something most people only dream of, eat, drink, and travel, and then eat and drink and travel some more for a living. Her days are long, and Coe is always on the go. She has boundless energy, does everything with a sense of great style, and has lots of fun. Along the way, she has turned herself into one of South Central Texas's most prolific social media influencers. Her more than 146,000 and growing every week, Instagram followers get to discover new places to eat, the coolest spots to hang out, and insights on where to stay and what to see around South Central Texas, as well as Los Angeles, Chicago, Colorado, and New Mexico. A Taste of Cocoa has been a labor of love. Back in 2010, Coe was studying to be a dietitian at the University of Texas when she realized a 9-to-5 job wasn't up her alley. So she ditched the textbooks and started blogging and writing restaurant reviews. I grew up in a small town in South Central Texas and wasn't raised on eating at nice restaurants or with a strong community. When I first started blogging, I didn't know anything about photography, writing, social media, or running a website, but picked things up along the way, she said. Fast forward to 2022, and Coe counts thousands of businesses, restaurants, and bars in Austin and Hill Country that she's been able to share with her followers. She admits working 70 to 80 hours a week the past decade hasn't been easy, but she wouldn't have it any other way. A Taste of Cocoa has been voted the best local Austin blogger twice, and Coe's been featured in numerous publications such as O and In Style magazines and the New York Times. While her travels have taken her all over the United States, Coe has a special fondness for the Texas Hill Country. I first visited Fredericksburg in 2015 and fell in love with the little German town, she said. The area is so special. Coe decided to release a pocket-sized guide to Fredericksburg earlier this month. She also has become a partner in an Airbnb close to Main Street. Guide to Fredericksburg is her second book. The first, Coco's Guide to Austin, was the number one bestseller in Texas books on Amazon. She calls the new book the ultimate guide to local restaurants, shops, and wineries in Fredericksburg. Her involvement in Sunday House Estate, her Airbnb, came about because over the years she had shared so many glamping experiences around Hill Country, and people were asking about more weekend getaways and quick trips. We took it over in January and did a complete renovation and just reopened in November, she said. Another one of Coe's favorite Hill Country spots is the Green River Inn in New Braunfels. The 14-room hotel sits on a cliff and has beautiful views of the Hill Country, she said. With Hill Country's growth, dozens of wineries are scheduled to open in the next year. It won't be surprising to see Coe exploring the area. And if you see me, don't be shy about taking a selfie with her, because if her mom is with her, she'll be taking pictures of you taking pictures with Coco. Our next article is also from the Express News, from the Recreation section. And this one's entitled, To Enjoy Nature, Free of Maddening Crowds, Time Your Visits to State Parks. This is by Shepard Price and Ryan Serpico, who are staff writers. Visiting one of Texas's 89 state parks is a great way to escape for some fresh air. But driving to state parks, especially from San Antonio, can be a hassle. Many require a day trip, and the closest which is Government Canyon, is a 28-mile drive from downtown, part of it along cramped Gaum Road. For those wishing to avoid the rush and hassle of crowds, it may be best to visit Texas's plethora of state parks during a certain time frame. While most parks are busiest in March, with 38 of the 90 tracked sites reporting their highest visitor numbers at that time, July, on average, is busier, with an average of 1,097,855 total visitors. 30 parks report that July is their busiest month, while March had an average of 1,022,870 total visitors across all state parks over the past decade. The time between March and July seems to be the busiest across the board. Just 5 parks reported their highest levels of traffic outside of those 5 months, including 2 in February and 1 in August. The other popular month was November, with Lost Maples, which has some of the state's best foliage, and Resacabe del Palma. Let me try that one more time. Resacabe La Palma, a popular spot for watching migrating birds, reporting increased traffic. The slowest times are outside of those months, although parks like Big Bend and Lost Maples report higher traffic then. Big Bend says its busiest time is October through April, with November, December, January, and March being its busiest months on average. The reason September, October, and December seem to be the ideal for visiting most state parks in Texas may be school-related, according to Texas Parks and Wildlife. Schools are back in session, so parks tend to be a little quieter during the week, Tara Humphreys, Director of Interpretation for Texas State Parks, wrote in an email. On weekends with good weather, however, Central Texas State Parks are often extremely busy and some are at capacity. Capacity limits are enforced to preserve the visitor experience and protect resources, Humphreys said. There is a notable uptick in traffic from March through August, as both March and July see an average of more than 1 million visitors. The 4 other months in the warmer half of the year see average visitor totals topping 700,000, with August being the lowest at 742,000. Then comes a noticeable drop-off in traffic, falling to 592,000 in September and an average low of 437,000 in December. Even in December, however, there are still things to do in Texas state parks. December often brings colder weather, so visitation may be a little lower, but many of our parks have holiday celebrations, Humphreys wrote. If you're looking to go to a Texas state park and avoid crowds but don't want to freeze during the winter months, the best bet seems to be September or October. It's also a chance to take in fall foliage before the November rush, when traffic nearly triples at Lost Maples. No matter what time you go to a Texas state park, you're not likely to have a bad time. But to avoid crowds, stick to the fall and winter months before the heat returns in the spring. There are many things you can do to avoid the rush, Humphreys wrote. You can reserve day passes, day and overnight sites, and some activities. Consider visiting a park during the week if you have that flexibility. Our next article is from the SF Gate, and it's entitled, Unexpected Monarch Butterfly Explosion Hits California's Pismo Beach Grove. This is by Andrew Prigden of the SF Gate. After a handful of dire years, the endangered western monarch is experiencing an unexpected population boom. The place to go? Pismo Beach, and this is the perfect time to see them. If you're heading south on the section of Highway 1 that bisects downtown of the tiny Central Coast enclave, you'll pass through several blocks of motels, restaurants, and retail storefronts surrounded by giant tracts of trailer and RV parks. As the road takes a bend toward the coastline of Oceano Dunes National Preserve, there is an anonymous-looking 2-acre stand of eucalyptus trees. That grove, once a small artichoke farm, is one of the most prolific population centers in North America, of the endangered western monarch butterfly. The Pismo Beach Monarch Butterfly Grove is one of five in the state that routinely records 10,000 or more of the butterflies in residence. But what makes this Central Coast destination special, even among other monarch sanctuaries in the region, is that it's both geographically and climate-wise the perfect spot to view the end of a multi-generational monarch life cycle, said Mallory Klassen, a California State Parks interpreter who has monitored the butterflies at the Pismo Sanctuary for the past 11 years. Essentially, it starts and ends here, she told SF Gate on a recent morning visit to view the monarchs. This generation you see here is what we call a super generation. They live for about 8 or 9 months, and they're the ones who will travel in the early spring, sometimes thousands of miles in search of milkweed. The males will mate and die, and the females will lay their eggs. Starting now through March, the super generation of monarch will leave the Pismo Grove to spawn. They will travel between California and the Northwest to reach their winter home. Once at their destination, their bodies will release a hormone when it's time to mate and eventually die. Then it's a 4 or 5 generation cycle of butterfly life. Hatch, live 2 to 6 weeks, lay eggs, and die as they make their return journey. The generation of butterfly that finally arrives back at the grove is the next super generation, and the process repeats itself once more. We come every year, and I wouldn't miss it for anything, Newport Beach resident Paul Malcolmus told SF Gate. Like many in attendance, Malcolmus was busy toting his cameras around the sanctuary during the early and mid-morning, positioning himself just right in an effort to get a glimpse of the butterflies, which open up their wings when the sun hits them. There's nothing like the monarchs, he said, and when you see them open up in a cluster, it's the most spectacular view on this earth. Once at the sanctuary, it takes a while to spot the monarchs in the eucalyptus. On first blush, the large committees of hundreds of butterflies, which hang from the branches in groups known as clusters, appear to be dead leaves. Wings closed and bodies still, the butterflies are brown and dreary, camouflaged. But once they unfurl the signature orange and black markings, the flash of color is a once-in-a-lifetime experience, Malcolmus said. I'm sure some folks might not understand waiting around all morning just to see 2 seconds of butterflies flying, but believe me, it's worth it. Although he was thrilled to be at the grove, Malcolmus said that he is concerned that recent inconsistent monarch counts in this grove and elsewhere portend an uncertain future for the butterflies. He's not alone. The International Union for Conservation of Nature classified the butterfly as a threatened species in July. Western monarch populations are showing signs of catastrophic collapse as the trees and plants they need to survive have continued to be decimated by logging, deforestation, agriculture, pesticides, and herbicides, development and climate change, according to the studies of more than 100 scientists and experts. It's been so sad to watch their numbers decline so much, so anything that might help them makes me happy, and I think that this designation might help them, Karen Oberhauser, a conservation biologist at the University of Wisconsin, told the New York Times. Although it's sad that they need that help, that they've reached the point where this designation is warranted. The population decrease is staggering. From the 1980s to 2021, the number of Western monarchs has declined by 99.9%. The Western population is at greatest risk of extinction, having declined from as many as 10 million to 1,914 butterflies between the 1980s and 2021, the IUCN said in a statement. The larger eastern population also shrunk by 84% from 1996 to 2014. Concern remains as to whether enough butterflies survive to maintain the populations and prevent extinction, the IUCN concluded. The count of Western monarchs hit an all-time low in 2020, with a population of less than 2,000. We made a little bit of a comeback last year and this year, but it has looked grim in the recent past, Amber Clark, an environmental scientist who has tracked the butterfly population since 2006, towed the SF gate. This year, our biggest count is 24,000, and that's kind of a miracle. It's something we can't explain. Word has traveled fast among the butterfly observing community that the monarchs are back in Pismo Beach. On early mornings, when the weather is just right, sunny and between 60 and 65 degrees, is when the monarchs are most likely to spread their wings. Crowds gather hoping to glimpse a miracle of nature that may or may not be around forever. I'm here with my mom, Brianna Heng Toad SF Gate. We make a day trip this time of year and the count is high, so we're grateful. Heng glances over her shoulder at her mother, Christina, who, as if on cue, removed a 2-foot telephoto lens out of its protective case. "Oh, wow, she's putting on the big one," Heng said, politely excusing herself. "I think something's about to go down." Our next article we're going to read is also from the SF Gate. And this one's titled, The Hidden History Beneath the Waters of Hawaii's Pearl Harbor. This is by Christine Hitt of the SF Gate. And this is dated December 7th. Looking across Pearl Harbor, the military presence in Hawaii is evident. An active Navy and Air Force base operate on its shores. Large ships and submarines dock in its controlled harbor. 2 million people per year visit Pearl Harbor to see the USS Arizona Memorial, but few know more than its military history. This large body of water, stretching 10 square miles with locks touching the central and leeward side of the island, was once pristine. Freshwater streams ran down from the Waianae and Kulau mountain ranges and drained into the harbor, creating a thriving ecosystem for sea life. Pearl Harbor is named for the pearl oysters that were once so abundant that they featured in Hawaiian songs and legends, but Pu'uloa is its traditional Hawaiian name. Inside the harbor's borders were 22 hand-built rock-walled fish ponds, more than any other location on Oahu. Some of them are so ancient that traditional stories say they were built by gods. It was easily one of the most productive and abundant areas in the state in terms of food resources created. Rehanan Tiari Chandler Iau, executive director of Waiwai Ola, formerly Oahu Waterkeeper, tells SF Gate. Western contact disrupted Pearl Harbor's ecosystem, and pollutants have turned a once pristine environment into a contaminated bay. After contact, that area got completely exploited by the plantations, Chandler Iao says. The water quality has suffered significantly over the last, 200 years. The sugar plantations stripped the land of forest, and native plants and streams were diverted, disrupting the harbor's ecosystem. The Navy dredged the harbor, displacing and smothering the many creatures living there. Then there was a boom in housing development in the mid-20th century from Aia to Waipahu and Iwa, which added to the pollutants. Most of the fish ponds were destroyed or filled in and used as additional land by the military and developers. For a long time, the native pearl oysters were thought to be lost, but Chandler Yao and her team at Oahu Waterkeeper found 4 of them during a restoration project in collaboration with the U.S. Navy and University of Hawaii at Hilo that used other types of native oysters to improve the water quality. After about 4 years looking for the pearl oysters and never able to identify them in the water, we finally got some to actually attach to our cages on their own, says Chandler Yao. Now the pearl oysters are in the hands of UH Hilo, where they are growing and reproducing. The hope is to reintroduce them back into Pearl Harbor with greater numbers. Our goal in the future is to bring back the pearl oysters as well as other species of bivalves, she says. Of the 22 fish ponds that were once made up Pearl Harbor, 3 remain today. I'm butchering that name, sorry. The most accessible is a 400-year-old royal fish pond, one of three owned by a queen of Oahu before Kamehameha I conquered the island. My family is connected to the harbor because our great ancestor, his name was Mikalemi, and he was the last caretaker of the fishing Anu, or shrine, of Pu'uloa. Says Kehulani Lum of the Ali'i Pa'ahi Hawaiian Civic Club, he did so by ensuring the Ku and Hina stones, Hawaiian deities, were honored. The Civic Club works with the U.S. Navy, which controls the land, to restore the six-acre fish pond that was hidden away until a naval archaeologist uncovered it. Many fish pond practitioners along Pearl Harbor died in the mid-1800s during the smallpox epidemic, says Lum. Chinese and Japanese immigrants stepped into the space and used the ponds as a fishery or rice field. Following the Pearl Harbor attack on December 7, 1941, the perimeter was off limits. Later, land around Pearl Harbor was condemned for military and government use. The plan calls for it to be fully restored to a working fish pond and to serve as a cultural, educational, and traditional healing space, says Lum. Since 2014, groups of volunteers have been peeling back the layers of mangrove. When we remove the pilikia, or problems, that has been placed in there, such as the mangrove, the garbage, and the invasive species, then the native species, you see them return, Lum says, and so we can kind of get a sense of the abundance that was there when she was alive. The fish pond has given the community a space to revive the traditional cultural practice, and with continued restoration efforts, the hope is that the fish will return as before. On the west side of the island, the nonprofit Hiu O Hu Ho Nua hopes one day that the fish in the harbor will be safe to eat. It's one of the newest nonprofit organizations formed to clean up Pearl Harbor's shoreline. Its founder, Tony Chance, a retired Navy CB, saw the rubbish and neglect happening on the shoreline of Pu'uloa and wanted to do something about it. This is not protecting. You don't protect people at the cost of their waters and their food, Sandy Ward, Hui O Hu Honua, co-founder and executive director, tells SF Gate. The group and volunteers clear the shoreline from trash and mangrove. It also seeks to create a public food system along the entire Pearl Harbor Historic Trail, which runs from Pearl City to Ewa. The hope, she says, would be to reclaim the West Lock Golf Course, once a taro farm, and turn it into a public food system. That's 80 acres of agricultural land that should be agricultural land again in the community's hands, says Ward. We thought that was a crazy idea, but it's gaining momentum. This would include food production, a farmer's market, a place for individuals to grow their own food, to create food sovereignty, and food security. Learning from mo'olelo, or stories, learning from either Hawaiian ki'ai, caretakers, it's such an important part of our mission, says Ward. That's a really important part of addressing that historical trauma to the lands, the waters, and the people of the Moku, our district. And my greatest joy will be creating pathways for young Hawaiians and young community members. Our last article of the day, also from SF Gate by Jim Glab, is entitled Roots. Study reveals which airline was most and least reliable. In this week's roundup, a new study of federal statistics determines the nation's most and least reliable airlines in a year marked by flight disruptions. Oakland is expected to have a new option for travel to El Salvador in the spring. Low-cost Zip Air begins flights from San Jose to Tokyo. Air Canada adds a long route from Sacramento next summer. And there's international routes news from Qantas, Delta, American, and Spirit Airlines. Low-cost Breeze Airways adds 5 new routes to Southern California. JetBlue unveils a major overhaul of its TrueBlue frequent flyer programs. TSA pushes back enforcement of its real ID requirement for driver's licenses by 2 more years. And Alaska Airlines promotion gives customers a quick way to achieve elite status in its mileage plan program. And the opening of Newark Airport's new Terminal A to passengers has been delayed until next month. As we near the end of a year that was famous for airline operational problems, canceled and delayed flights, lost baggage, long airport lines, and so on, the folks at NerdWallet decided to pore over a range of data from the Bureau of Transportation Statistics to see how U.S. carriers performed. Given the lag time in reporting and posting of data, they analyzed numbers in several categories from July 2021 through June 2022 and crunched them together to determine an overall winner. Among the 9 airlines in the study, Alaska, American, Delta, Frontier, Hawaiian, JetBlue, Southwest, Spirit, and United, NerdWallet created a 5-point scale that ranked Hawaiian Airlines as the most reliable U.S. airline with a score of 5.0, and JetBlue as the least reliable with a 1.6 score. Hawaiian ranked first in on-time operations with 86% of its flights arriving within 15 minutes of schedule, while JetBlue ranked last with a 65% on-time rate. Hawaiian also performed best in a percentage of flights canceled at 0.81%, while JetBlue came in 8th with 3.81%, although Spirit was worse at 4.11%. Hawaiian had the smallest rate of mishandled baggage, while JetBlue ranked 7th. Alaska and American had higher rates of mishandled bags, respectively. And here's a remarkable statistic on passenger bumpings. That's when a passenger with a confirmed reservation isn't allowed to fly because the flight was overbooked. Hawaiian didn't record a single involuntary denied boarding for the period analyzed. On the other end of the spectrum, Frontier denied boarding to 5,657 flyers, while American did the same to 7,912 passengers, NerdWallet said. In international route news, Sacramento is expected to welcome new Air Canada service next summer when the carrier introduces 4 weekly flights to its hub at Toronto Pearson Airport beginning June 2nd. Qantas has launched new nonstop 787 service 3 days a week between Dallas-Fort Worth and Melbourne, Australia, supplementing its existing Dallas-Fort Worth to Sydney flights. The 17-hour Melbourne flight will be code-shared with Qantas partner American Airlines. Delta this month started flying a seasonal triangular route 4 days a week that goes from its Atlanta hub to Johannesburg, South Africa, and continues to Cape Town before returning to the U.S. And on December 17th, it plans to add separate nonstop turnaround flights from the ATL to Cape Town 3 days a week, so both South African cities will have daily service from Atlanta. I'm sorry, but that's all the time we have to read Travel Today. You've been listening to Travel here on Owl Radio. You can listen to Owl Radio on our specially tuned radio or by streaming on your computer or smartphone. You may also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at www.owlradio.org. Thank you for listening. This program will be replayed after 9 p.m. this evening. This is Jeff Chandler saying goodbye from Owl Radio.